The Meaning of Geranium from The Secret Language of Plants by Andrina, read by Sam Gabriel, based on the works of J.K. Rowling. Chapter 13. The Cave of Polyphemus. Creature apparated into Hogwarts. Warded or not, this is something that house elves can do. Although what most people don't know is that just because it is possible doesn't mean that it is easy or painless. Much of the special house elf magic, the great warding of a house and the apparating in protected places, involves a considerable degree of pain. This is not common knowledge, but the bitter truth is that even if it were, very few people would care. Maybe a few more in later years, even since Hermione and the riots. The excuse that house elves would pick it up didn't work anymore in Hogwarts. You don't leave your clothes scattered around, Justin. Creature had been weakened by his efforts to hold the house closed. Even if the master and the other one had been helping, he had been weakened. Crossing the wards to Hogwarts had taken what little energy remained in his thin old body. But there he was, and completing a task set by a master always gave that little rush of pleasure and power to a house elf. Enough that Creature could keep on his feet. The house in which Creature served was exploding. He wasn't free. He hadn't been freed. Not that he wanted it, but he was missing a house nevertheless, and he could feel it in his teeth and in his bones. A house elf without a house was like a being with no heart or no blood. It couldn't be. It was agony. Creature could only take a step before falling down.
We're going to need Longbottom. This elf is in a state.
Creature had been found soon enough and taken to the infirmary. Madame Pomfrey had given him a boost of energy and even got him to wake up, but she could do nothing to stop the sobs that had captured the elf as soon as he opened his eyes. Dobby and Winky were at the foot of the bed, standing on tiptoe and looking at him sadly with big wet eyes. They had been called to see if they could do something to calm down or throw any light as to his ailment, but nothing that they did managed to comfort the bawling elf. Madame Pomfrey realized that as much as she knew of injuries and illnesses, be they magical or not, and Potter and his gang first and the Weasley twins later had certainly tested her knowledge, she had only the most rudimentary idea of how to treat a house elf. Granger's platform had seemed a bit silly and a bit unnecessary at first. Now it seemed too little and too tame.
"Did something happen in the kitchens?"
wondered one of the Ravenclaw girls that had found him. Creature had indeed been aiming for the kitchens. It wasn't proper for a house elf to apparate anywhere else when coming to a house, but he had been so weak and panicked that he had only gotten to the dungeons, which was quite fortunate. There was a constant traffic of Ravenclaw girls coming and going from the Slytherin common room because they were all ridiculously in love with the underwater window. They had gotten to Creature almost immediately. Winky shook her head.
"No, miss. Everything is fine in the kitchen. He's not from Hogwarts in any case,"
pointed out Dobby while anxiously squeezing one of his ears. Creature's sobs were nerve-wracking. There was a sudden opening of various pairs of eyes. Oh, Merlin, oh no, they had just put back everything. If this was someone else sending a message of another surprise visit, please no. Gregory Goyle had been really upset about pretending to torture Parkinson, even if it was just make-believe. Please, not again.
"Call the headmaster,"
said Madame Pomfrey sternly before softening her voice to talk to Creature.
"Mr. Elf, can you tell us your name, please?"
Creature was crying too hard to say a word. He had buried his face between his hands and rolled into a ball that shook with the force of his sobs.
"The portraits say that Longbottom went to the greenhouses around an hour ago,"
said Theodore Nutt as he entered the infirmary.
"But Black Baby Nair, not sure how good he would be with an elf, though."
Longbottom was the default choice when someone was upset. Sirius's style was different and didn't seem suited for someone crying so hard, but if he was closer, they may as well call him. Nothing they tried seemed to be working, and since they were on it, maybe they should call Headmaster Snape, and they didn't want to panic, but maybe Lupin and McGonagall too, because this elf seemed very, very upset, and he was not from Hogwarts. and they were all wondering what could make a house elf cry so much and make him come here to cry. Sirius came sauntering into the room with his usual dashing smile and that spark in his eyes that made everyone stand a little bit straighter. You couldn't slouch in the presence of such a good-looking man. He seemed surprised when he saw there was an elf on the bed, but his steps didn't falter as he came closer. His eyes opened wide.
"Oh, Merlin!" he exclaimed.
Which, as it happens, is not what one wants to hear in a health ward. Sirius's eyes were shining very blue.
"Is that... creature, is that you?"
The elf was a total wreck, but he still managed to lower his hands from his face to look at Sirius.
"Master!"
The students fidgeted. There's no way to reproduce how utterly broken the elf sounded.
"Creature, what are you doing here?"
Sirius flailed a bit with his arms before moving forward and sitting on the bed. The elf was very small. There was plenty of bed for someone else to sit on. Sirius's hands hovered for a second over Creature's back before he dared pat him gently.
"The master and the master came to the house,"
said Creature through the tears that were still choking him.
"And they helped Creature complete master's orders. But now the Lord has come, and they had to go. And the house is broken, Master. It is broken."
"So, is he having a stroke, or am I? Because that didn't make sense."
No. It's all in the inflection," Sirius said quickly.
He put his arm over Creature almost as if he feared he would be taken away because of his mad ramblings.
"So,"
Sirius went on, "it had been years since he last saw the house elf, and he still wasn't over the shock. He hadn't really thought about Creature or the house. He actively tried not to ever think about that terrible house.
Someone came to the house and helped you complete a task Regulus had given you. Is that right?"
The elf nodded. He was, incongruously, wearing a flower-patterned old-fashioned jacket, complete with tails and pockets. Creature had been assured it was not clothes, not when he knew perfectly well it came from an old tablecloth, so he was free to wear it without worries, and everyone else felt better at seeing him more decently dressed. Someone offered him a handkerchief to blow his nose.
"But now they're gone, and you're in Hogwarts because... Master told Creature to come, Master. Okay."
People perhaps would be surprised to learn that Sirius was a very patient man, explosive and intense and so full of emotions that they went over the brim, but there was a certain persistence about him that made him quite patient if not restrained. He could be patient now as he helped Creature up from his nervous meltdown and figured out the mystery that was his presence here.
"Do these new masters have a name?"
Creature blew his nose on the handkerchief, and a soft voice murmured that he should keep it, really, I have more. He took a big breath, and he looked at Sirius with his dirty green eyes, and he told him. They were holding an emergency meeting in the corridor outside the infirmary. The meeting had started inside the infirmary until Madame Pomfrey pushed them out because the chatter disrupted her patients. Her current patients were the Carrows, who were still sleeping in a dusty corner of the room, and Creature, who had calmed a little bit, telling the story to Sirius, only to start crying again when he got to the part about the attack on the house and how it was gone. Sirius tried to tell him that as the actual rightful owner of the house, he didn't care much about its destruction, and it was fine for him. However, it didn't seem to help much. At last they got Creature to fall back asleep, and although he was curled tight into a ball, he didn't look so distressed as before. Apparently finding a master, even one less liked like Sirius, helped the poor elf's psyche. Sirius couldn't believe it. Grim old place. He would never have guessed it. He hated the place. Hated it. It was the last place on Earth he would want to go back to. Yes, the last. Second last was Azkaban, obviously, but Grim old place still took first position because Sirius had been dreadfully miserable there and he had felt it. You didn't feel much in the way of emotions in Azkaban. But Harry and Draco had gone and made themselves comfortable there, and apparently cleaned a bit and cooked and brought Granger. Maybe they had been miserable too, because Sirius couldn't conceive anyone being happy in that house. But the idea that they had been there and they had been safe rocked his world. That such a terrible, terrible place where Sirius had been scarred early in life could somehow come to serve a better purpose was unthinkable. Of course, the fact that it had been destroyed was also extremely satisfying.
"He says they escaped via flu," Sirius told the small crowd standing in the corridor.
He had already told them that. He had in fact started with the fact that Harry, Draco, and Hermione Granger were at Grimmauld Place, but not anymore, because that was obviously the most relevant fact here.
"And something very weird happened when Harry duelled Dickface."
Sirius was not calling Voldemort Volamon or whatever other alternative people had come up with because they were all ridiculous, but he was not calling him you-know-who either because Harry and Ron were right. It sounded too much like you were afraid. Dickface it was, and he hoped it became popular and that it got back to his ears.
"But," started to say one of the latest refugees. Originally, the meeting was only for Severus and Minerva and Remus and, well, all the people you wanted to have around when there might be an emergency. Professor Flitwick, Sprout, Sinistra, some Weasleys. But of course other people had come to see what was going on, including this one, a muggle-born witch in her 40s, tough like a nail and with a grievance to repay. She had lost a brother and a husband to the war, but she had saved a younger brother and a niece, although they weren't in Hogwarts with her. They turned to look at her. She had come to the group because she was tough and she was brave and she was willing to fight, but she had arrived to the school less than a week ago and she didn't have any tasks assigned yet. She was still scared and in pain. There was tension in her shoulders and her arms and in the way she carried herself. She still asked for permission before entering another house that wasn't Gryffindor, and even in Gryffindor too, because she wasn't a student anymore. She had cried a bit when she saw the Slytherin common room.
"Transportation has been restricted for weeks now. All the lines in the flu network had been redirected to the Ministry," the witch said.
Doreen, yes, that was her name. A ridiculously soft name for such a hard woman.
"What?" "All fireplaces take it to the atrium, so they can check your travel papers and see if you have permission to move."
The good thing was that she spoke clearly and calmly, even though she understood very well what this information meant. She didn't let panic choke her voice, and that was a blessing.
"And the night bus has been requiring identification since September or so. It is apparition or nothing. Even flaying has become dangerous."
"Oh, God. Oh, Merlin. Oh, no, no, no."
But on the other hand, looking at this calmly, Harry had duelled freaking Voldemort, and maybe he hadn't won, but he certainly hadn't lost. And people dared saying he wasn't a good wizard. Suck a pickled egg, you. Harry was an excellent wizard, and so was Draco, and they were both Sirius's godsons, and they were perfect, even if Draco went and broke his wand, so technically he didn't count as a wizard anymore. Sirius didn't care. Besides, Hermione was there. Sirius thought very highly of her. The girl had kept an adult witch locked in a chives jar for months because that shrew had written mean things about her and her friends. This was exactly the kind of ruthless revenge and overreaction Sirius loved. He wasn't kidding himself. Harry was too sweet to kill anyone. But Hermione would. Oh, yes, she would. The floor and the walls were black, with green highlights. All very Slytherin, he had thought at the time, when he first came to the Ministry. It gave the impression that they were not only underground, but underwater, too. It was also quiet. Well, not exactly, because there was the murmur of a few different conversations, but after the raucous turmoil of Grimmauld Place, this place felt muted. This was not the place where he wanted to be. Harry had come from the fireplace with such momentum that he had fallen, and he was now on his hands and knees, hence the view of the floor. He shook his head and scrambled to get up, eyes darting around looking for two faces and not knowing whether he wanted to find them or not. Probably not. Let this be Harry saying the wrong words, and let them be in the leaky cauldron. If things went bad, they could run out of the pub. Harry would figure out something. But no, Hermione was looking at him from across the atrium, having come from another fireplace. And even if he didn't understand the words, he could tell that was Draco's voice in a litany of "Meld, meld, meld." Harry could hazard a guess of what that meant.
"Transport papers and wand, sir."
Papers
and wand.
A few fireplaces down to his left, Draco kept speaking.
"C'est une catastrophe. Nous sommes foutus. Alors, calme-toi, calme-toi. Respire."
"Sir, we need to see your papers,"
one of the Ministry wizards was saying in the standard talking to foreigners style, which is louder and only slightly slower than usual speech. He waved his wand and pointed.
"And your wand for registration."
"La putain de sortie est si loin. Je ne sais pas comment nous sortirons d'ici. Mais heureusement, vous êtes un crétin et ne savez pas qui nous sommes."
"No papers, huh?"
said the wizard, standing in front of Harry, whom he had been ignoring in favor of looking at Hermione and Draco. He was a big man with a very dark beard. It was so dark it almost looked fake, like it didn't belong in that face.
Yes, papers. You know, I think I may have dropped them just before I got in the fireplace."
"Oh, sure. Never heard that one."
"Yo! Albrechtson!"
Albrechtson was obviously the official standing before Harry. He dropped a hand on Harry's shoulder before turning around to see who called him. Draco was entangled in an irate discussion with his officer, who kept screaming the same English words again and again while Draco apparently read him the French version of the Riot Act and gave the impression of being very foreign and very dissatisfied with England. Draco was clutching a pouch, although by now he had stopped using the original bags and instead had little balls of tissue paper with the wand components inside, so pouch wasn't the word. Perhaps cartridge or even bullet or shell would be better, and Harry was perfectly aware that this was not the time to think about it. "Please, brain, let it go." Draco had one paper ball in his right hand and three others in the left ready for use. Harry gripped his wand tighter. His assigned wizard obviously hadn't noticed his scar yet, and if they didn't connect the platinum blondes to the Malfoy name, then maybe they could all walk out of here.
"Doesn't this one look like the undesirable?"
said another wizard, dark gray robes and red lining from across the atrium. He was standing in front of Hermione, and there was a witch dressed with the same gray uniform pointing at her with her wand.
"What?"
Obviously, Albrechtson was somewhere in the bottom of the barrel of idiots assigned to this job.
"That's not Potter, that's a female!"
There was a small pause in Draco's tirade. A pause that said, "I am personally offended by your idiocy and considering blowing my fragile cover just to point out the depth of your stupidity, sir." Thankfully, he went back to talking to his assigned wizard. He probably was telling him just that, but in French.
"The mudblood, I mean!"
cried the wizard. Hermione was keeping silent and smiling beatifically. They hadn't taken her wand, probably because they hadn't realized it was one. Still, you would think they would take the long, pointy needle.
"He thinks that's Potter,"
Albrechtson chuckled, very much in the manner of Vernon Dursley. It is one of the most irritating things in this world, stupid people who will laugh when someone shows them the truth. He looked at Harry, expecting some agreement and some laughter, even if he was still planning to send him to the cells below, and two of the dozen neurons in Albrechtson's mind rubbed together and sparked a thought about the black-haired, green-eyed, bespectacled young man standing before him.
"Nocte Maxima,"
said Draco, and all the lights in the hall blinked and turned off. Of course, when faced with sudden darkness, a wizard's first instinct is to cast Lumos. Very scared of the dark wizards, who knows why. They, on the other hand, Draco and Hermione and Harry, were less worried about the darkness and more about punching, kicking, and or hexing the nearest wizard. Nothing personal, although maybe it was a little bit. There was a short shriek, surprise and pain combined together, which spoke of someone being stabbed with Hermione's needle. Harry pushed Albrechtson to the floor and kicked around until he heard the sound of a wand rolling over the polished floor. Of course, although the darkness gave them a small advantage, it was also a problem, since they couldn't see where they were, and more importantly, where to go. Harry solved this problem quite expediently, because he knew that Draco was on his left, and what's more, he could hear him cursing and something that sounded like an epic slap to the face. There was a gentle flash of purple light, enough to tell Harry where Draco was, and it wasn't too difficult to grab Draco's arm and then crab shuffle to the right until he bumped into Hermione. Once he got a good hold of her, Harry simply started running. The destination didn't matter as much as being together. There were cries and calls for backup and various attempts at Lumos that did very little in such a big hall until someone remembered that Lumos Maxima was also a spell that existed. For Merlin's sake, you all, what a sorry excuse for a wizard you are. Get off the floor, Albrechtson. They're getting away.
Your attention, please. All Ministry wizards cleared for combat and with authorization to perform arrests are to present themselves in the atrium immediately. There are three individuals classified as undesirables, numbers 1, 3, and 4, attempting escape from the premises. We remind you that they are extremely violent and dangerous. Accept caution at all moments. Everyone else, please remain calm and alert for any signs of suspicious activity. Remember, it is your responsibility as well to help us build a safe environment for true witches and wizards. Collaboration with criminals is a corruption that will not be tolerated. If you see something, alert the appropriate authority immediately.
Who in the seven hells is undesirable number two? Who could ever be deemed more important than Harry Potter?
I don't know about number two, Draco, but Harry is undesirable number one for sure. Draco blinked quickly, looking at the poster Hermione was holding that indeed had Harry's photograph, the one from the Triwizard Tournament, with the number one and the reward printed in big, bold letters.
Yes, I knew that, he said,
in the same way a cat would pretend not to have fallen from a table, having intended to do that all along. He blinked again.
Wait, does that mean that I'm third? I've never been third in anything in my life.
Some days it was really easy to see that Draco and Sirius were related. No,
if anything, I'm third and you're fourth, Draco.
Oh, here they were again. It was moments like this when Harry missed Ron so much that he could hold the feeling in his hands. Ron wouldn't be able to do anything about Hermione and Draco fighting, but he was always willing to play some game with Harry to pass the time. Ron had developed quite a philosophical acceptance of the things he couldn't change, probably because he grew up in the Burrow. The thing is that Hermione was the best student in the school. Everybody knew that. She was miles and miles above everyone else, with the exception of Draco Malfoy, who was breathing hard on her neck and fighting to abandon the second position with all his might. Draco was number one in potions, because Severus blatantly favored Slytherin students. Someone had to, he said. But Hermione was first in transfiguration, because maybe Minerva didn't want a Slytherin to be first, although she was not giving anything for free to Hermione. People said that going to Arithmancy with them was like going to a gladiatorial fight in which the public could be injured. To this day, they still fought over the proper plural form of Horcrux. If you want me to say Horcruxes, then you have to accept Animagi, Granger. And over that time in their third year, when they argued so much about the correct translation in ancient runes, that someone else gave the right answer before them and got the house points. Professor Babbling had been so relieved. Harry, who, unless Neville was having a bad day, held the honorable position of being Hogwarts's worst student, thought that grades weren't that important to begin with. This wasn't the typical defense of a bad student, though, not at all. It is not that Harry dismissed grades because his were bad. It was just that in his heart of hearts, Harry knew he was probably the best student in potions, but Severus Snape couldn't very well go giving an outstanding grade to the son of James Potter. Same with Defense Against the Dark Arts. True, many of the things he could do weren't in the books and thus couldn't be graded, but on the topic of dealing with dark creatures, he was by far the most knowledgeable student, and he could cast a fully formed Patronus before the age of 14. He just wasn't showing it, partly because he really didn't care about school, and partly because he thought it was to his advantage if everyone believed he was a hopeless wizard. Don't let your enemy know your strengths and all that. But to the point.
You know, I don't think that list reflects actual threat level, he said, because he should cut the fight short.
Really, those two would drive the Ministry to the ground or farther underground, as the case may be, if it meant getting a better grade in the list of most wanted criminals. For someone who fought so hard against the establishment, they were both quite eager to be on top and excel at everything. For now, though, they all sat on boxes of pre-printed forms and inkwells inside a supplies closet, waiting for the corridor outside to empty while they thought of an escape plan. So far, the only good idea they had come up with was to find a little-used room, say the archives, and accept that they now had to live there, because there was no way they were going out through any of the usual exits. It had been made clear that they were all locked and bolted, and anyone who came near them would be subjected to a thorough search.
"We'll have to move soon," said Hermione.
Her eyes kept going back to the poster that announced the reward for Harry Potter and/or his wand. Having the poster in the closet seemed a bit excessive. Harry dipped his finger in one of the inkwells and proceeded to paint a funny mustache on his photograph. It was a horrible, horrible, horrible idea. But Harry was oddly stubborn about it and quoted the Odyssey at them, which no one would have expected. Really, what kind of readings had Harry done? But since they could not come up with a better plan, they had to settle for this one and prepare for when it inevitably went wrong. The plan consisted of going back to the atrium where all the Death Eaters, or as they were calling them, but come on, all the Death Eaters, whatever their official classification, were gathering to hunt them down. Harry reasoned that they wouldn't look for them in there, and maybe they would learn something important. There was, of course, the obvious risk of being recognized and hexed as soon as they got a good look at their faces, but Harry thought that if he focused a lot, he could maybe use with the three of them the same magic with which he disguised himself back when he left Hogwarts. It probably wouldn't be very good, because even then it had been kind of clumsy and he hadn't really practiced it. But it would be enough to maybe throw off the first impressions, and as he kept repeating again and again, it wasn't as if they were simply walking back to the atrium, oh no. They had sheep's fleas, so to speak. It was unbelievable. But it had been such a weird day already, one in which they had sadly skipped lunch, that they didn't feel like arguing when the universe handed them a piece of good luck. Hermione had opened one of the cardboard boxes because having official stamped paper was always a useful thing, and instead of finding, say, pre-signed travel documents, she got three sets of robes in their sizes, one green, the other two somewhere close to magenta. Why would they store robes there, three of them? Why? What kind of crazy coincidence was that? There was a piece of paper pinned to them with a smiley face and the letter G. But as already said, they were growing tired and hungry, and official robes plus Harry's magic were good enough, better than simply sitting there waiting for someone to cast Hominum Revelio at the door. Hermione had a hair tie on her wrist, a good, resilient one. They had seen all the rubber hair ties spontaneously snap and fly away, and on one memorable occasion hit Draco on the neck. He claimed she had done it on purpose, although there was no way she could have done so. She tied her hair now in what they had all learned to call in their minds the ponytail of serious business. Harry preferred to wrangle his hair into a braid because he really was some kind of small god of the meadow. They would go under the monster's eye and out of the cave, yes they would.
"Stop looking at your feet,"
Harry chastised Hermione in a whisper.
"I'm sorry for not wanting them to look at my face," she whispered back angrily. "It draws attention to you. You should be looking around searching for us."
Harry was in fact making a show of looking around, bending to look under chairs and tables, peering behind doors and plants, and on one occasion lifting a fat wizard's cloak to look at what was beneath. He was also wearing the lime green robes, because of course in a sea of grey and gold-lined black and the occasional dark magenta, he would be the only spot of eyesore green. The worst part was that it was working. It was so brazen that it seemed that anyone with a half-functioning brain immediately dismissed the possibility of them being anything other than ministry officials. Hermione huffed, but she did raise her chin and nodded to the next wizard who walked by. The man nodded back and went on. They kept moving down corridors and chairs and elevators, more or less following the flow of wizards that were spreading through the locked ministry until they had no idea of where they were. Hermione saw a sign that pointed to the canteen, and it was unanimously accepted that they should go there, because things are always better when you have just injected a sandwich. They stood in a corner, so it would look like they were still searching for themselves. It was agreed that the turkey and Swiss sandwich they were eating was subpar, but the only other option was egg and cress, and it just did not look like the right choice for either a daring escape or the thorough search they were supposed to be doing. They also had an apple each, not a sweet red and gold one, no, but one of those really green apples that seemed to be composed of sourness and tartness and all the vitriol of an old racist relative. All in all, it was a sad lunch, and the room was extremely cold. "We are doing this wrong," said Draco as he glared at a junior official who was about to sit in the table closest to them. The man quickly scurried away, leaving behind a big chocolate brownie that Hermione had no compulsion to claim for them.
"I think we're doing fine," pointed out Harry sagely.
All things considered, they were doing pretty well. Not great, because great required a far better lunch, but they had gotten food, and they had gotten, if not away, out of the Ministry's claws and out of Voldemort's, talons. "We're no closer to finding an exit, and eventually they will start counting or asking for ID. That was true. Maybe not that the Ministry would check all of its workers one by one to see if they had some extra people, but they certainly couldn't keep for long the part about them walking around aimlessly. But what do you want?
The place was in lockdown. It's not like they were spoiled for choice of exits. We have to start looking for heads of department, Draco said, giving up on his apple. It was inedible.
What? Heads of department? Have you gone mental?
No, listen, Draco went on, waving them to keep silent. Heads of department. It is an unavoidable fact that the higher the position in the superstructure, the more corrupt they are. If someone is going to keep a little something for themselves, it is going to be one of the bosses. We go in, say we're inspecting everyone, they can't really say no. Eventually, someone is bound to have something we can use. I think you're right, Hermione conceded. And you have no idea how much that annoys me. Both of you are right. I don't know how to feel about it. In a better world, it would already have caught us, Harry said, patting her arm. A Hermione-directed ministry would never have let them run around freely simply because they had gotten the right robes and attitude. It was a good plan, and Draco was right, and yet... Clodius Brownlee, the head of transport, was the obvious first choice, and indeed he had the flu network open for him whenever he wanted. However, he had already been visited by another patrol, which put their current presence under question. All they could find was a collection of pornography in Brownlee's desk, which wasn't enough to make him open the flu for them, and they could not think of another excuse. Perhaps they could have done it, given more time to think, but they were too nervous about it, and even though it had been Draco's idea, he still couldn't believe they were doing such a ridiculously Gryffindor cheeky trick. Draco looked very disappointedly at the head of transport while holding one of the magazines with both hands. Whether it was the possession of the magazine or the lack of convenient dishonesty that caused the disappointment, it wasn't clear. Such a debased taste, sir. Draco tisked at him as he flipped the pages with the barest touch of his fingers. He really knew how to effortlessly talk and act like someone who belonged to the elite, someone whose status was far superior to yours. I do hope there are no mudbloods in here.
Of course not, said the man quickly. Although one could wonder if that information was at all available in the magazines. For what little Harry could see, it didn't seem to have much text.
Although I can't believe that a proper pureblood witch would accept to be portrayed in such a demeaning position, Draco frowned.
It was not a Severus Snape frown. This one had a different character, and it carried more class strength. It was all in the shape of the Malfoy eyebrows.
So what is it, Mr. Brownlee?
Brownlee.
Indeed.
This, however, was a pretty accurate mimicry of Snape's tone.
Tell me, Mr. Bramwood, are you aroused by impure women, or by the perversion of properly pure-blood witches?
Clodius Brownlee did not know the right answer to the question, and that lack of knowledge took over his mind, erasing any notion of suspicions as to this sudden second visit from the special operators.
I will be confiscating this, sir.
Draco rolled up the magazine and passed it to Harry.
You can expect the Department of Morality and Pure Blood Spirits to follow up with this case. Good day, sir.
As far as they knew, there was no such thing as a Department of Morality and Pure Blood Spirit, but given that there was an actual Department of Mysteries and that people accepted not knowing what they were doing in there, it didn't seem like reaching too far. They tried the sub-heads of section next. One was drunk, and Harry took his wand and put it in a drawer because it wasn't safe for him to attempt any magic at the moment. The other had been appointed to the job, but no one had ever seen her in the office. She had a house elf come collect the paycheck.
"Carry on, gentlemen, ladies," Draco said, strutting out.
The robes billowing behind him made for a very nice figure, very nice indeed. Harry couldn't help noticing that.
"Keep alert and don't hesitate to speak up,"
Hermione added. She did not carry herself with the majesty and power she wished she had at the moment, but she sounded earnest enough. Truth was that Hermione still had some fears with her and the knowledge that if she were captured, they wouldn't give her a quick death. None of this was easy for her, but she was still doing it. Never let it be said that she was no Gryffindor. Harry said nothing. He was busy enough keeping the shallow glamour that disguised their features. Also, and he had no idea how that happened, he was still holding one of the rolled-up adult magazines from the head of transport and a small bag of treats that he had acquired by hitting someone on the head with the aforementioned magazine. He had mumbled morality, and that had been enough for the poor fellow to relinquish any notion of complaining. See, a lime-green robe, department unknown, and already he was abusing his power. It was things like this that made Harry think he could end up becoming the next Dark Lord, at least until they told him about the Horcruxes. Now he thought he just needed an adult role model who could go for a week without breaking any rules. That ought to teach Harry some proper ethics.
Would Mr. Weasley... No, he had a flying car. So who did Harry know that was a law-abiding citizen? Oh, Percy. Percy seemed very law-focused. He would ask him. The head of registration and identification sweated a lot. Certainly more than them who by now had gotten the rhythm of this business and weren't afraid any more that Harry's glamour would fall or that they wouldn't sound authoritative enough. Aunt Draco's pressing. Merlin, he just knew exactly how to ask. The man confessed he was accepting bribes and sexual favors in exchange for a name added or dropped from the mudblood list. He also had something called pixie dust in his desk and multiple bottles of troll whiskey. Draco tisked and tutted at him and said he was issuing him a warning. Hermione put a curse on the coat rack when no one was looking. Registration and identification was a big space, yet it felt closed and airless and too hot, as if they were working from inside a cauldron left too long on the stove. What a horrible place to be. They were all very glad when they left. The head of financing was skimming money and including all her personal expenditures in the budget. She also had her assistants run personal errands for her. But she had nothing to get them out of the ministry, not even if they threatened to have her arrested if she didn't help them to get out. She had spent almost 1,000 galleons on the latest broomstick models for her family, and yet she was just as stuck as the rest of them in the locked building. She stared at them, shifting her weight from foot to foot, and already blaming her assistant for the embezzlement, even though they hadn't said a word about it. Draco rolled his eyes so hard he must have been able to see the last week. On their way out, Harry said morality again and got them what he had hoped would be a bottle of cold butterbeer, but turned out to be simply beer. Still, they drank it between the three of them because they were all hot and thirsty. The new head of the Auror office, freaking Walden McNair because there is no justice in the world, had doubled his fortune by appropriating all the belongings of the Muggleborns and half-bloods incarcerated. He allowed his staff to terrorize everyone else regardless of blood purity and take whatever they wanted. But he did not have a way to get them out of there, and he smelled bad. Besides, this was an actual Death Eater with his arm branded, so they didn't feel so sure around him. If he got too scared, he might murder them right there. They left quickly. Draco murmured something about them merely following protocol, and they would now let McNair continue the good work. They just needed someone from a different department to check on them. Have a good day, sir. It was odd and irritating. Draco was right when he said the people on the top weren't following the rules, except for the one rule that would be convenient for them to break today. That rule everybody was following, and the whole building was on lockdown. Every 2 to 3 minutes, they blasted a message about them over the megaphone. The first half-dozen times, it made them tense, and Hermione couldn't help jumping a little bit. Draco looked perfectly calm, but then again, Draco was really good at pushing down his anxiety. He had spent years looking like everything was fine when it was not. However, after a while, they and everybody else had learned to push the message to the back of their minds and stop paying attention. It was there, a constant reminder of the state of emergency, and everyone's nerves were frazzled, but it was also becoming routine. They had spent close to 3.5 hours now wandering around. It was starting to be frazzled, to become embarrassing that they hadn't been apprehended.
Your attention, please. 3 extremely dangerous undesirables, numbers 1, 3, and 4, are attempting to escape. Remain vigilant and cooperate with the officials working to detain them.
I hear they went to registration, said a witch with blonde half-length hair and a cute little dark blue bow on the side of her head. Her friend, all dressed in blue, leaned a little bit to hear better. They were loitering by the elevators, looking at the signs and wondering where to go next. Harry was starting to think of small catastrophes that would force them to evacuate the building. The twins could have helped them with that. What a pity. Or Seamus Finnegan.
They say they entered the place blasting curses and saying terrible things. The head of the department was being choked by a coat rack when help arrived. Had some bones broken and everything.
Collaboration with criminals is a punishable offense.
But did they catch them? Oh no, apparently they escaped just in time, the witch said.
Her voice was carefully modulated so as not to betray her feelings about that escape.
Larry says that many of the desks caught on fire, she went on. Spontaneously?
She added 2 or 3 more extra vowels to the last word. Why, it almost gave the impression that the fire might have been deliberately provoked by the workers there.
They lost weeks of work.
Remember, failing to report suspicious activity is considered treason.
Oh dear, that's a pity,
the blue-dressed witch said quickly and primly.
Yes,
answered the witch, and this time there was quite a lot of happiness in her voice. They waited in silence for the two women to get on the elevator and leave.
At last they were once more alone.
Did we?
I only did the coat rack, Hermione said.
Okay.
Harry took a deep breath. I wanted to burn it all down, but I don't think I got to it. But maybe put a delayed curse without noticing? Or maybe people were seizing the opportunity when they saw it.
Yeah,
Draco pointed with a long white finger to the department's sign. Very nice hands, Draco's. Harry was a big fan of them and the things they could do. We haven't tried this one.
Your attention, please. There are three individuals classified as undesirables, numbers 1, 3, and 4, attempting escape from the premises. We remind you that they are extremely violent and dangerous. Accept caution at all moments. Everyone else, please remain calm and alert for any signs of suspicious activity. Remember, it is your responsibility as well to help us build a safe environment for true witches and wizards. Collaboration with criminals is a corruption that will not be tolerated.
This message is becoming grating. 0.5% of my drive to get out of here is to stop listening to it, Harry admitted. And so, tired and irritated and with their hunger only a bit sated, they knocked on the door of the office of the head of propaganda and communications.
And the fireplace is appropriately closed.
Draco was magnificent at this. Draco would make a really good spire con man, except he had spent a summer without suffering from anxiety, and he had found that he quite liked the feeling, and he would prefer not to make a habit of this.
Yes, sir,
the head of propaganda and communications answered. It is blocked and redirected to the atrium like every other fireplace part of the flu network.
Of course.
The office was big, but it felt a bit crowded with the four of them there, especially because they kept trying to stand close together and they could feel the curious stares of the people working outside.
Are you quite sure, madam?
Draco asked with that Malfoy tone that implied that they already knew the answer but were nevertheless giving you the gracious opportunity to explain yourself. She hesitated a little bit. Hermione gave her a serious frown. She wasn't anxious anymore. She was, like her wand, hard and sharp and full of power.
Well, this is the fireplace in my private office, you understand,
said the head of propaganda and communications in a generally friendly manner. She had a voice, this woman, one of those voices that made you contemplate sticking a pen in your ears.
High officials such as myself are given certain privileges. We do perform a very important job.
Hermione's frown increased. She did not approve of rule-breaking, and she had had a day full of it.
This is a serious matter we're investigating, said Hermione with a gravity that was all too real,
like that time Seamus set their beds on fire and they all thought McGonagall was going to chuck him out the window.
Top 5 undesirables?
Yes, yes, of course I'm aware. Funny how uncomfortable this woman, the head of propaganda, looked now, even if she was still valiantly trying to smile.
Collaboration with criminals is a corruption that will not be tolerated,
Hermione went on. She was terrifying. Harry could almost feel bad. He didn't, not at all, but he guessed he could.
Of course not. I came up with that line, you know, she said,
puffing her chest out and toying with a pearl necklace. She was wearing a big ring with a silver snake holding a green stone in its jaws that she was hoping they would notice.
So what kind of privileges are we talking about?
Draco asked. Draco was being the good cop to Hermione's cold assurance of murder.
Surely not a direct line.
He smiled smoothly. It was the warm smile of a lioness that was going to hunt you down and feed you to her cubs.
Well, no. I go through the same security protocols just as anyone else when coming in.
The head of propaganda assured them in a posh, proper accent that was very irritating.
Polyjuice use is a very serious concern of ours. We know that plenty of mudbloods have made use of it to impersonate proper pureblood wizards, just as they often steal their wands.
Time's of the essence here, madam, Hermione interrupted, probably because if she had to keep hearing this, she was going to blow their cover in a spectacular manner. Out of all of the departments, they had to come here.
I believe all this blabbering could be considered obstruction.
I agree. Draco still sounded amicable, which made that agreement all the more terrifying, like he would politely and cheerfully escort you to your execution.
No, please,
she begged. And this was the key. You put them against the wall, showed them they had done something wrong, and they started defending themselves and completely failed to notice the strangeness of the situation.
They stopped wondering at the three random ministry workers investigating the place rather than some proper Death Eaters turned Aurors. No one's position is secure in a dictatorship. They only had to remind them of this.
I just meant to say I come in like everyone else, but I can use the fireplace for going out. And I have already gone through security by then, you see, and this is more efficient with my time. Just a short list of pre-checked locations, of course. It wouldn't do to have the fireplace completely open. The minister himself signed on it.
Promising, very, very promising. But this only added to the tension they were all feeling. We will have to check all of them.
Just my house, you know, and a couple of shops in Diagon Alley and...
Address? Draco extended an elegant hand. She showed them the list, frowning and with lips pursed. She was perhaps starting to realize that this was not at all the usual manner in which an investigation was conducted.
I didn't know there were people cleared for combat down in the archives, she said,
probably referring to Harry. At least she was speaking in his direction, so that's what the lime-green robes meant. Well, that was just plain wrong. Lime-green was not and should not be the color for archives. Archives should be orange or brown, probably a boiler orange. There had been attempts at tampering, he said simply. He couldn't spare much attention for talking, focused as he was on keeping the glamour up. He had to work extra hard when there were many people looking, doubly so if they knew their faces. Draco was chest deep in the fireplace, the green flames of the flue licking at his robes.
"Oh, lovely curtains," they heard him say before emerging back. "And I assume the fireplace is protected from that end?"
"Well, of course, I am a high official. I'm sure many a mudblood or muggle would love to try something against me, or at the very least gain unlawful access to this office through my residence. We, propaganda and communications, are one of the most important pillars of the state, if not the most. The Department of Morality and Pureblood Spirit will love to hear that," Hermione said in a glacial tone.
This was it. Draco had been right. They never followed their own rules. They could go out and... they would figure out what to do next once they were out of here. This was it.
"Will that be all?" asked the witch.
The hand with the ring was now in her hair, bringing attention to the silver snake earrings. As if a stupid pair of earrings would make her more of a pureblood. At this point, Harry wouldn't be surprised if she turned out to be muggle-born. "One last check, I think, and we will be on our way," Draco said, throwing them a very meaningful glance. He was clutching the snake-decorated jar with the flu powder. Of course, that wouldn't delay them much, but better if they took the powder with them. Harry started to discreetly shuffle closer to the fireplace while Draco went on a detailed and spiraling explanation of that one last check to keep everyone distracted. The fireplace wasn't very big, so they would have to really squeeze together. The head of propaganda and communication frowned once more, her eyes going from Draco to Harry and Hermione. It really was hard to keep the glamour up, and there were quite a lot of people pretending not to look at them through the glass. She had already been suspicious, and now she was starting to wonder, to doubt herself.
"What was her name again?"
Hermione was right behind Harry, asking in a careful whisper. Her voice clung to the neck of her robe.
"Cloris?"
Harry snickered. "Dolores." Hermione pushed Harry towards the fireplace with her hip. He had no idea what she wanted to do, but just in case, Harry took hold of her arm, his right hand already gripping Draco's. Draco tossed half the contents of the jar into the fireplace and stepped in, dragging them behind. Hermione looked over her shoulder and smiled, and it wasn't cruel exactly, because Hermione was not a cruel girl, not at all. She was good, and she was kind, and she cared about house elves. But this woman, this despicable monster, she was cruel and a sadist, and she had escaped with no punishment for her actions. And now they were seeing her here, in the top seats. There was a war and people were suffering, and this woman, who had once denied the return of Voldemort, was here thriving. So yes, there was a bit of pleasure in Hermione's smile for the pain she was about to inflict.
"Thank you so much for your help, Dolores."
Hermione spoke low enough that it could still be called a whisper, but loud, oh, loud enough that all the eavesdroppers by the door would hear and report back.
"We wouldn't have made it without you. Truly you have a friend in Hermione Granger."
The words were followed by a screech, half of it produced by Dolores Umbridge, who was darting forwards, trying to catch them and forgetting there was a chair in the way. The other half belonged to Draco, who was clutching Harry's hand tight in excitement while he squealed like a newborn goat. Harry pulled Hermione into the fireplace, and it was just for a second or two, but still Harry dropped the glamour completely and winked at the audience. If he weren't holding fast to Hermione and Draco, he would have waved. It was just a second or two before Draco got a hold of himself long enough to bellow Umbridge's address and disappear through the flue. But for those 2 seconds, everyone near Umbridge's office could get a glimpse of the 3 undesirables escaping. Imagine the fire. The fire of the fireplace from which they escaped, the fire in the Department of Registration and Identification where the names of the Muggleborns and Half-Bloods burned, the fire boiling the blood of the Death Eaters of Voldemort, the absolute fury that swept over the Ministry. Imagine then a room where there was no fire, no smell of smoke, not the sound of cracking wood. A room where nothing warm ever entered, a place that wasn't cold but aseptic. Empty of everything worldly. In that room, far away from the fire of the world, a woman waited. The Lady in White. The escape, first from Grimald Place and later from the Ministry, brought consequences. Voldemort was furious and scared, so scared. And he couldn't show the latter, so he put all the energy into the former. The officials minding the fireplaces, Albrechtsen and the others, were summarily executed, which was tragic and fortunate in a way. Maybe they were good people doing their job and trying to survive in a mad world. Or maybe they were bad and had enjoyed their work a bit too much as they sent person after person to the holding cells. Maybe they really believed in Voldemort's fantasy of a pure-blood world, or maybe they just enjoyed the opportunities the new regime offered. The fact that they were the ones on the right side of the holding cells when the door closed. Whatever they were, it didn't matter now because they were dead. They were killed quickly, though, so they could consider themselves very lucky. The Dark Lord was angry, and he wanted to exact a punishment fitting to his rage. The quick deaths of the transport officers weren't enough. So the others, the chief of security that let them escape, the stupid woman who opened her fireplace, even the head of registration who allowed his office to burn, they were in for a long trial that would be torture in itself. And then some classic torture as they were interrogated and eventually, unless something truly miraculous happened, death. The problem with this kind of regime is that they don't treat anyone well, not even their own. Through all this, Narcissa Malfoy said nothing. When he arrived at the manor at the end of the day, her silence was a balm to Voldemort. She kept her mouth closed and her eyes downcast and her hands always ready to serve him. Sometimes she noticed him looking at her and she bore his gaze standing tall and straight and silent. Like those Greek statues of women at the entrance of a temple, letting her eyes get lost in the distance. She hated that gaze, and she also feared a little bit what could be in there. But she endured it with calm and grace. Narcissa used to dress in black and green and whatever color her husband chose for her. But lately she liked dressing in white. She felt that the white was both a shroud and an armor, surrounding her and making her this white, silent figure, this miracle of marble that moved. Nobody spoke to the Lady in White because nobody thought the stone could answer back.
"Bellatrix speaks Spanish,"
Voldemort had said to her one day. He was slouching in an armchair, sitting with his legs spread open like men are given to do. What a funny thing that women are told to spread their legs like an insult, like a demeaning obligation, yet men would do it unprompted. Narcissa was assaulted by the thought that out of the whole world, only she was privy to the most private moments of Voldemort, the times when he allowed himself to lean back and rest his legs, when he let his head fall back on the back of the chair. She thought that he might be having sex with Bella and that other young man, one of the Mulcibers, but even they didn't get to see this. She wasn't sure exactly what it was. He was not vulnerable with her, nor honest, but there was something less controlled about him, less of a projected image. He was more at ease. He allowed himself to be almost ugly, almost normal, almost human. Thrice already, Narcissa had seen him drink. Even if she never saw him eat anything,
Yes, my lord. Narcissa had mastered a tone that, without being an irritatingly meek whisper, still managed not to sound like an intrusion. A voice that wasn't a voice.
Do you too, Sissa?
No, my lord. Spanish was too emotional. It was a wonder that Bella had been allowed to study it, because a pretty young woman like herself speaking Spanish was almost sinful, especially with her mouth and her lips. But then again, Bella was allowed all the inappropriate things that were forbidden to Narcissa, and she still managed to find a hardness in the language. She spoke Spanish less like the seductress she sometimes wanted to be, and more like an acolyte to Torquemada.
But you speak other languages,
Voldemort had continued. Others, perhaps, would find it vexing that Narcissa gave him the shortest answers possible, and never provided information without prompt, but not Voldemort. He liked to feel in control, like he could pluck her very thoughts out of her brain. Yes, my lord, Narcissa had said. And then, because there were some limits, she added, French and German.
Say something in German,
Voldemort ordered now with a wave of his hand. He remembered. A short exchange from weeks ago, and he remembered. He was a powerful wizard, but more than anything, he was a man that seemed to know all. A man who could find your most private thoughts and gently take them to the surface, and from there keep them in his mind. He knew everything, and he didn't forget. But he waved at Narcissa now, because with her around, he sometimes rested his wand on a side table by his armchair, that used to be Lucius's. Such little threat Narcissa was that he could not allow himself the luxury of not holding his wand in his hand at all times.
Knabesprach, ich breche dich. Röslein auf der Heiden, she said at once.
Because if you are asked to say something in another language, it is always good to recite a poem or riddle. Everybody hates the question, what do you want me to say? They don't care. They just want to hear you speak and do the trick.
Röslein sprach, ich stecke dich, dass du ewig denkst an mich, und ich wirst nicht leiden.
It is good, Narcissa,
the monster said to her.
I may ask you to do it again some other time. You may retire now.
Yes, my lord. End of chapter 13. For the full text of this and other stories by the same author, visit the AO3 and Tumblr pages of Endrina. First pass editing by Ohana. Music by Sean Johnson. Special thanks to Sakiko. If you would like me to record a story, voiceover, or character, please get in touch with me using the contact information found on my website, which is located at samgabrielvo.com. There you can also find all the other stories that I've read, as well as links to my Discord server, where I record things live for your enjoyment. And finally, as always, thank you for listening.